You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. I want to give you a heads up on a great event that's coming up, so you can go ahead and get it blocked off on your calendar. It's called the Denver Real Estate Investor Success Summit, and it's hosted by Yourcast Real Estate and Pine Financial Group. It's an all-day event that is full of education from local experts. Plus, after the event, they're hosting a happy hour for networking purposes. And actually, the first drink is included in the registration price, which is only $19. And look, this is not some front for an event full of sales pitches or $15,000 boot camps at the end of the day. There's none of that. It's all about learning and networking with other local investors. And so it's happening on Saturday, October 20th. So make sure you go ahead and put that on your calendar. And I'm actually helping them with the website. So I've had the privilege of sitting in on some planning meetings. And I can tell you, they put a lot of work into putting the event together and also pulling in some great speakers and presentations. So go to denverISS.com. That's Denver and then I for investor, S for success, S for summit.com. Or search for Denver Real Estate Investor Success Summit on Facebook. Now, remember to block off Saturday, October 20th on your calendar. If you got any questions, feel free to reach out to me, reach out to Charles, or reach out to one of the Pine Financial Group guys. All right, here's the show. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another podcast episode. So this episode is a continuation of our series where we talk to a couple of local lenders around Denver so you can learn the lending side of investing in real estate. So today I have Joe Massey of Castle & Cook with me. Joe, how's it going?
Doing great. Talking to other lenders, I'm already offended. Chris, what are you doing? I thought I was your main guy.
Well, you know how it goes, man. We gotta let everyone know out there, good people to talk to.
I know. I'm just teasing. You're not the only realtor I know. I'm just joking. I don't want to be the only lender you know either.
I was going to say, honestly, like everyone already knows your stats because if you got the Joe Massey spreadsheet, like you've already got, I think, minor celebrity status with a lot of people on the website.
I'm trying. I'm like a mini Kardashian. So working my way up one of these days. So.
I think you have a little bit more work to do on that. So Joe, let's get into it. Like, how'd you get into lending?
So I graduated from college in 2001, in December 2001, right after 9/11, and it was a tough job market. And I graduated from Colorado School of Mines with a degree in economics and business. And trying to figure out what I was going to do and had reached out to the folks that I had worked for as an intern when I was in college. And I had done a couple summers worth of work for a company called Mellon Mortgage and had worked for some consultants there. And, you know, my job was not exciting. It was organizing the file room, making copies. But I reached out to those folks and said, hey, you know, I recently graduated and was curious if you're hiring, and managed to get a job at a company called Aurora Loan Services, which at the time was an independent mortgage bank, but then was eventually bought out by Lehman Brothers, and worked there for a time period, did a little bit of commercial lending, but that was 2002 when I started in the mortgage business and really started ramping up into retail residential originations in 2004. So 16 years in mortgage, but really 14 years focused on the residential retail side, like what we're doing now.
Okay. So as you know, a lot of our listeners are investors or aspiring investors, and you've actually written a blog post for the website a few months back where you talked about your investing strategy.
Yeah.
Could you just kind of give a quick recap of your investing strategy and how you're using your HELOC to kind of fund your investments? It's a very interesting strategy to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So first thing I'll tell you is the key things I look for. I want a property for listeners nationwide. You might not know this, but here in Denver, inside the C470 loop, I want a property inside the C470 loop, less than $5,000 of renovation needed, and a cap rate of 7% or better. And those are the three things that I look for. The reason being, inside the C470 loop, I can get to it within an hour if I need to. Number two, renovations. I am not a contractor. I don't know how to manage a project. Well, I know a little bit about it, but I don't really want to do it. So I want really minor renovations. And then 7% cap rate, that's just the metric that I look at to make sure it's a good deal. And so when that deal comes across my desk, what I do is I have a home equity line of credit on my home, my personal residence, and I will advance that. Let's say it's a $200,000 property. I would advance my HELOC and buy this property for $200,000. Then over the coming months and weeks and years, get that property rented out, start making payments back to myself. Let's just say this property is rented for, you know, $1,500 a month. I'm going to take that $1,500 a month and apply that back towards my home equity line of credit. I'm also going to take any ancillary income that I generate doing mortgages and apply that back to my HELOC and work on paying that HELOC back down to zero. And then hopefully a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, that HELOC has paid off. Another deal comes across my desk and I do the same thing.
So, I mean, you're a numbers guy, obviously. Why aren't you taking advantage of historic interest rate lows, slapping a 30-year fixed term rate on there and getting as many properties as possible and doing a 30-year, you know, mortgage payback?
It's such a great question. A lot of people say, Joe, oh my gosh, your investing strategy is so conservative. And you know what? It really is. But my job is extraordinarily high risk. I'm 100% commission. My job can change based on a regulatory change or change in the economy overnight. So my job is super high risk and my investing strategy is moderately low risk. So you combine the two and I'm right in the middle that I'm a moderately risky investor between my job and my investments. So I'm really comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the high risk of my job, but I'm not comfortable having super high risk or in this case, super high leverage on a lot of rental properties.
And that's one of the things I love hearing the different perspectives because there is no right or wrong way. Of course, we all plug numbers in our spreadsheet and say, we should do exactly this.
Right.
But spreadsheets don't meet real life.
That's right.
So, I mean, how long did it take you to come to that strategy? And to throw another question in there, you lived through the bad times as a mortgage officer. Like, how much that influenced your strategy?
A lot. I know a lot of people that lost their homes. I know a lot of people that lost their investment properties. I did loans for a lot of people that were buying foreclosures. Had to turn down a lot of people that couldn't get loans because they were going into foreclosure. And I really saw from a ground level the foreclosure crisis and everything that happened there. It impacted my income. My income was the lowest it's ever been in 2009, 10, and 11. Now we did okay, but there was a lot of stressful months and stressful years. And so living through that, I now know that there will be another downturn in the market. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't know what's going to cause it, but I know it's going to be there. And the more free and clear real estate I can have when we hit that downturn, the better off I'm going to be as compared to having a lot of real estate that is highly leveraged and maybe I can't sell it if suddenly I'm upside down. So I definitely would say that tough times in mortgages made me a more conservative investor. But I realized that that was okay to be conservative on that side because I'm ultra risky in my job.
And I think that's a really good point of view. One of my issues with reading and talking to people about real estate investing strategies, it's only one slice of the pie. You don't get the bigger picture.
Right.
Because if you take in, like you said, your job, the family, other things going on, you have to balance that risk and cash flow and reserves and everything. So I appreciate that perspective. So I could talk to you for another like hour about your strategy, but
sure.
For people out there listening, go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com and go to education, investing strategies, and you'll see, I think the title is just Joe Massey's investing strategy. Mm-hmm. Read up on it. He talks about not only real estate, but stocks and some other investing as well. So really good perspective. And actually I'll put a link in the show notes as well. So Joe, I mean, you're an investor, you're on the loan side, you've seen the good, the bad, the ugly. What are some of the common or biggest mistakes you see investors or aspiring investors make when it comes to buying property?
Sure. Boy, gosh, there's a number. There's an easy one that I can see that investors make is they work with the wrong lender. Now, that's a little bit of a selfish statement because I think I'm the greatest lender in the world and everybody should work with me. And somebody will call and they're like, I'm working with Wells Fargo. Thanks so much, Joe. We appreciate, you know, all the information in your class. So I'm kidding. Not that Wells Fargo is bad or Chase is bad or anybody like that is bad. But I do get about 30% of our business is someone that's been turned down by another lender. And they'll come over to us and they're so frustrated. It's been 6 months. It's been 3 months. I've even had people that were working on trying to refinance for 18 months and they came over and we were able to close their loan within 30 days.
I mean, what's the main difference? I don't know too much about the nuances of lending. So I mean,
I would say experience. The average loan officer tenure is 3 years from the time they get into the industry until the time they're out.
Okay.
I've been in the mortgage industry for 16. So that means I'm 5 times more experienced than the average loan officer. And it's not all experience. I know some guys that are fairly new in the business that are really good, but I think it's just not every lender does a great job. Not every lender understands the unique needs of investors. Not every lender focuses on that niche. They might do 2 investment transactions a year and 20 residential purchases a year. So it's just not something that a lot of lenders do. So that's an easy one for me to say is working with the wrong lender.
Let me jump in here before the next one. So I mean, and this might be, you know, an ignorant question almost, but I mean, isn't a loan officer, aren't you just collecting the paperwork and then sending off to underwriting? And they tell you yes or no, we can underwrite this?
No, it's a little more nuanced than that. And that's such a great question. So, you know, when we give a pre-qualification, so you apply for a loan and I say, hey, Chris, I've looked at all this. Yeah, you're pre-qualified. Give me your documents. We're going to get you pre-approved. So it's my job to really pre-screen that information. And we are going to have our underwriter review it for the pre-approval piece, but it's my job to look at it and know right away, hey, is there a problem? Do you have a credit issue? Do you have a income issue? What about the collateral? So yes, my underwriter is going to make the final decision, but in an ideal world, 100% of the files that I send to my underwriter get approved. It's my job, if I'm good, to catch that stuff ahead of time. It's not my job to just throw something against the wall and see what sticks. And that's the way that the majority of loan officers work, is they tell everyone yes, then they send it up and, oh, sorry, my underwriter turned it down. Well, you should have turned it down, Mr. Loan Officer, not the underwriter. You should have caught it weeks ago. And that's what I focus on, is catching that information right up front.
That makes sense. Okay. So you were about to go on to like a second common mistake or issue you see before I do that question at you.
Yeah. Next thing I see is carrying costs. I see folks make mistakes with letting their renovations take too long, buying a property and saying, oh, it's only going to take me 30 days to renovate it. And then 6 months later, they're still working on it and they don't have a tenant in there. Whether they're paying my loan or they're paying a hard money loan, I see carrying costs just eat up profit for investors. If you're going to buy a rental property, get that thing fixed up, get the tenant in there immediately. And on that same note, I'll see people, oh, I have this place listed for $2,000 a month. I got four people that want to rent it for $1,900, but that's just not worth it. And they'll let it sit vacant for another month before they find somebody at $2,000 a month. Well, that 1 month of $2,000 that they just missed out on, and the difference was only $100 from somebody that wanted to rent it before, it takes you 19 months to make up that loss. All right. That's a year and a half. So I see investors make really, in my opinion, obvious mistakes on letting their properties sit vacant because they want $50 more or $100 more. For me, it's all about no vacancy. I mean, I've let tenants renew in my places for 6 years and I've pumped up their rent $25 or $50 a time. It doesn't have to be. And you know what? It's under rented, but I don't care because the rent shows up every month and it's never sat vacant for 6 years. 1 or 2 months of vacancy can crush your profits for the entire year. So don't let carrying costs, whether it's renovation or vacancy, eat into your profits. That's a big one I see.
So, I mean, I'm going to call you Mr. Spreadsheet Guy because you design the spreadsheet that we use all the time and a lot of the people do it. I mean, and that's, you know, spreadsheets are very black and white.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can often mislead people because, oh, the spreadsheet says this. Now, obviously, like, how do you balance, hey, the spreadsheet does this, but here's being practical in the real life. Like, what tips can you give people?
I think if someone is offering you money to rent your place, you should highly, highly consider taking it. Just because you put in the spreadsheet that I'm going to get $2,000 a month, you've got somebody there that wants to give you $1,850 and they're going to meet your minimum credit criteria to qualify, I think you should really think about taking that money. Same thing, renovations. You put in there your renovations were going to be $3,000 and it's going to be $4,500 to get it done right. Pay the $4,500. Or also on that time, I see people make this mistake. They get three quotes from contractors. One guy is $5,000. He can do it in 2 weeks. One guy's $4,000, it's going to take him a month. One guy's $3,000, it's going to take him 6 weeks. They'll go with the guy that's $3,000 and it might take him 8 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks. That time that that property sat vacant, you could have paid the expensive guy to do it in 2 weeks and had that property rented out in half the time. So it's not always about the cheapest thing. It's about don't let the property sit vacant.
That is great advice. So what are the typical like common questions you get from investor clients when they come to you for financing?
Yeah. Number one thing I get is, hey, Joe, I don't have a job or I'm self-employed. Can I get a new loan? And yes, if you're self-employed, about 30% of our clients are self-employed and we're going to review your tax returns, your K-1s, your business tax returns. And we're going to look and see how does that income flow. And if you're self-employed and you make money, we will absolutely give you a loan. If you're self-employed and you're broke, we absolutely will not give you a loan. And you make that choice every year on April 15th when you file your tax returns. So I know that accountants listening out there are really good about write-offs and getting rid of that taxable income. But the more you can work with your lender and the more you can work with your accountant to find a balance between paying some taxes versus paying no taxes, by paying, having a little bit of taxable income is going to help you qualify for those loans. So that's the number one question I get.
And I know exactly what you mean. I've I've played that game a lot, and I still play the game of, hey, the more you write off, you know, the less taxes you pay. But then I've had years starting from previous businesses where, yeah, I mean, I make no money on paper. So is there like a guideline for, I mean, how much, you know, essentially profit mm-hmm. does a self-employed person need to show to even begin to make, be able to apply for a loan or qualify for a loan? And that's a really hard question.
Yeah, that's so to answer your question, we will allow you to spend up to 50% of your annual or monthly income on all of your debts. Now, that's the direct answer. All debt that's on your credit report.
Okay.
All right. All debt that's on your credit report, because business debt should be coming off before your income, before your net income.
Yes.
So your net income, if your net income is $10,000 a month, we'll let you spend up to $5,000 a month on your debts, and we'll still give you that loan.
And that's including my primary mortgage, student yep. debt, credit card debt, car loans, everything, right?
Exactly. Yep. Any sort of debt that's on your credit report. Now, let's say you make $10,000 a month in your job and you have these three rental properties and they're all cash flowing and making you $300 a month. Well, we're going to give you credit for that $300 a month for those rental properties as well. Where I'll see people have problems is their top line revenue might be $200,000. They write off $190,000 of expenses. They just made $10,000 last year. And then they call me like, Joe, I made 200 grand. I want a new loan. I look at their information. I'm like, well, you told the IRS you only made 10 grand. That's a problem, because I've got to have that verified income. So 50%, but more importantly than that, let me look at it, because there's a lot of things. And that's part of my background. I mentioned I did commercial loans for a little bit. That was one of my specialties, was reviewing business tax returns. And that has helped me be really successful in helping our self-employed clients when it comes time to buy a home or buy an investment
property. And usually it's the past 2 years of tax returns?
2 years, okay. Correct. 2 years. And so like right now we're in May. If you filed an extension for 2017, then I would need your 15-16 returns and your 17 extension. So the two most recent filed taxes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any other common questions you get from people?
How much down? That's a big one I get. A lot of people think you have to have 20% down to buy an investment property. We actually have a program where you can have as little as 15% down. It's very popular for my beginning investors. They'll put 15% down on two properties instead of doing 20 or 25% down on one property. It allows you to buy two properties. Here in the Denver market, they're going up as much as 10% a year. Come back 2-3 years later, we'll take cash out of those properties, eliminate the mortgage insurance, and give you enough cash to buy another one or two properties with 15% down.
Now, real quick, just what's the basic like term difference as far as like points or interest sure. rates on 15 versus 20% down?
Yeah, it's going to have a higher rate, generally about 0.5% higher. It's okay. going to have higher closing costs, probably going to be an additional 1 point origination or discount. And you're going to have mortgage insurance, which is going to range from, you know, 75 to maybe $185 a month, depending on the size of the loan.
Now, if I just put 15% down and keep that long term, does the mortgage insurance automatically drop off once I get up to the 78% or 22% equity?
Correct. Once okay. you've paid it down to 80%, you can call and have that mortgage insurance removed. If you forget to call, it goes away. Once you've paid it down to 78%, it goes away automatically.
Okay, yep. Great. So, I mean, you've talked about your background in some commercial lending. Mm-hmm. Give everyone just what's the difference between a commercial lender and a conventional lender? Just those terms get confusing.
Sure. So conventional lending, this is what I do, where we're going to lend to individuals. So Chris, you want to apply for a loan. Maybe you're self-employed. You've got a business. That's terrific. I'm going to give a loan to Chris Lopez, not to Chris Lopez's business, not to Chris Lopez's LLC or trust. We're giving loans to people, to individuals. Commercial lending is going to be basically everything that's not conventional. So you want a loan for your business, you want a loan for your property in a trust, a property that's in an LLC or an S corp, that's going to be a commercial loan. And that's going to be a whole different universe, that every commercial loan is really going to be customized by that individual commercial bank. Everything I do conventional is going to be pretty standardized, usually 30-year fixed, 15-year fixed, maybe a 5-year or 7-year ARM in your personal name. Down payments are going to vary 15, 20, 25%. It's going to be really standardized and pretty straightforward. We're going to ask you for two paycheck stubs, two bank statements, two W-2s, two tax returns, et cetera. Whereas commercial could be all across the board. They might ask you for your articles of incorporation, personal guarantees, business profit and loss statement, business asset statement. I mean, it's going to be very customizable depending on that individual bank.
Now, is there a litmus test that people can do at home or in their mind that says, hey, I should talk to a conventional lender versus commercial? Like, what are some general tips you could give.
Yeah. So conventional lending is always going to have the most favorable terms. What I mean by that is a 30-year fixed at the lowest available interest rate. Commercial is always going to have higher interest rate, shorter term, and usually a shorter fixed period. Most commercial loans are going to be a 20-year term. Interest rates are going to be variable. They'll usually be fixed for the first 3 years at prime plus one or prime plus 1.5, and then will become variable after that point. And often there will even be a balloon after 5 or 10 years on a commercial loan. So things like that can really make an impact on your cash flow.
And let me just slow you down there for a second, because yeah. I mean, you know this stuff so well. You rattled off very quick, and I retain about half what you said. And that's just because, I mean, you're firing
this
stuff off.
You can rewind. I'm just teasing.
Hey, people are out there driving. You want them to drive safe, Joe.
That's right.
So just a scenario. So let's just say I take out, like, I'll say $100,000 loan just for easy okay. round numbers.
Sure.
$100,000 loan, you know, for conventional lending versus commercial right now. I know interest rates change, but can you give some examples? Like, hey, we're at this percent now for conventional, this percent now for commercial. These are different payments.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say you did that loan with me, $100,000. You could do a conventional loan as little as 15% down. You're going to have a payment probably $900.
Okay.
Now let's say you're going to do that same loan on a commercial loan. You're generally going to have 25 to 30% down. So as much as double the down payment, and your payment's probably going to be $900 to maybe $1,000. Reason being, it's over a shorter term. My loan, I'll let you finance it over 30 years. Commercial loan is generally going to be over 15 or 20. All right. So you're going to be paying that property off a lot faster, which is great. But guess what? You're probably buying this property for cash flow. So let's just say that this property is going to rent out for $1,200 a month. If you've got a payment of $900 or $950 with me, you're going to make $250 to $300 a month. If you've got a payment of $1,000 a month on your commercial loan, you're only going to be making about $200 a month. So it depends on your goals. Generally, commercial is going to have a higher payment, higher down payment, which equals a larger cash investment, and not allow you to stretch out and buy as many properties.
And what would be, like, just right now, what we're like May 24th of 2018, like, what would the interest rate be with a 20% conventional with you versus a commercial? I know it changes, but just
sure.
some perspective.
Yeah. So for me, on a 30-year fix, probably 5.5%. Commercial loan, if it's fixed for the first 3 years, probably going to be 6%.
And that will probably be like a 5-year ARM, you're thinking?
It'd probably be a 3-year ARM.
Okay.
And then variable after that.
Okay. Yep. And then as far as like points and origination fees, like, because usually commercial, you usually have to pay a point or two, is my understanding, right?
Correct.
Can you talk about that? Like,
those are going to generally be pretty similar.
Okay.
You know, most commercial loans are going to have a minimum of 1 point. If you're doing only 15% down with us, you're going to pay, you know, 1 to 1.5 points, but you could do 25% down with us and pay 0 points. Whereas on a commercial loan, you'll always have at least 1 point origination.
Okay. Now, I know with some clients we worked with in the past, you've been the lender, you know, doing the financing side, and then you get the HOA docs from a condo. You find out it's non-warrantable.
Yeah.
And you guys have scrambled. You've helped the client scramble and work with a commercial lender.
Yep.
So first, talk about what a warrantability is, means in the complex.
Yeah. It just simply means that the project is eligible for conventional financing and eligible for mortgage insurance. And it's no more complicated than that. Can you have a conventional 30-year fixed rate loan? And there's some minimum requirements that the complex has to meet. For example, they have to have sufficient reserves. They have to have low delinquencies, not be involved in any litigation. They have to meet requirements on insurance, having sufficient insurance on the property. Owner occupancy is a big one that people focus on. There are some nuances to that. For investors, we want to see that it's greater than 50% owner occupancy in the complex, so less than 50% investor concentration. But basically what we're looking at, are there problems in the HOA? And if you have problems in the HOA, maybe we don't want to lend there because those problems can be leading indicators for future foreclosures.
Great. And I mean, without going too much into all the nuances of that and what commercial lending is, like, mm-hmm. I've seen Joe with clients like, hey, if you refer someone out to commercial lending, that's no longer, you know, good for you necessarily from your own personal standpoint. Mm-hmm. But like, you do the right thing, you help people out. And that's one of the things I like about you.
Yeah.
So if you guys have questions about investing or not sure what your complex does, talks to Joe because he does. Gives you the straight truth, I'll say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've run into that where, you know what, a client will begin working with us. They have, I don't know, XYZ Homeowners Association, you know, property number 123 in there is under contract. We'll get that condo questionnaire back and we're going to review it within 24 hours. And we're going to call and say, yep, this complex is good, or no, it's not good. And if the answer is no, we have a really close relationship with First Bank that we can refer the client right over there and they can get a loan there.
So, and First Bank is a commercial lender.
First Bank is a commercial lender. Yep. And we also have an option for an alternative non-warrantable loan, but we really don't use it here in Colorado. Reason being, the rate for that plan is between 1 to 1.5 points more expensive than what First Bank does. So the only time we really use it at Castle & Cook is in markets where First Bank isn't at. So a real good example is Las Vegas. They have a ton of non-warrantable condos there, and we'll do our non-warrantable plan there because First Bank doesn't have a presence there. Here in Colorado, could I do a non-warrantable loan? Yes, but it's frankly better for the client that they do it with First Bank. So my job is to have a great relationship with the folks at First Bank that I can refer that client over because it's a better deal for them.
Now let's change gears and talk about deals. I mean, you buy properties, you help clients buy properties. Like, any recent deals that you can talk about that just basic numbers, interesting stories?
Yeah, I have one client who is great about purchasing properties using a hard money lender and fixing them up. And then once the renovations are completed, he'll come to me and we'll do the refinance and pay off that hard money lender. And he rents out that property and makes a lot of cash flow. So a really good one recently, anybody that's my Facebook friend that probably saw this out there, he bought a property and renovated it. Total investment to purchase and renovate the property was $187,000.
And home, condo?
It was a single family home. He found it by door knocking. He had the NED list, the notice of election and demand, and was just going and knocking on those people's doors and found this one where they were headed to foreclosure and said, hey, I'd like to buy this property. I'll help you pay off the loan, give you some cash, et cetera. Property needed a little bit of work, but got it under contract, purchased it, and financed the renovation. So his hard money lender gave him the loan to buy the property and pay for the renovation. He spent $187,000 to purchase and renovate the property.
And you say light renovation. Is it just like, I mean, a it paint was job, new kitchen? Like
paint, carpet. I believe he had to redo the bathrooms. And I think there was some issues at the back of the home. I want to say like the siding and whatnot.
Okay.
Nothing, no structural, no roof, nothing like that. So pretty light renovation. We got that property appraised and it appraised for $265,000. So it took a month or two to do the renovations, got the renovations completed. We appraised the property for $265,000. I gave him a new loan up to 75% of the value of that property to pay off that $187,000 loan. We financed in his closing costs on the new loan. The only cost he had out of pocket was his payment to his hard money lender. He had to pay the hard money lender. I think his payment was a little over $2,000 a month. And he had about three payments while he owned the property. So he invested right at $6,000 in carrying costs. Did the refinance with me. His new payment is $1,300 a month. That's how much he sends to Castle & Cook Mortgage every month. And that property's rented for $2,200 a month. So he's making $900 a month in gross cash flow after paying the mortgage. He still has, you know, some expenses if he's got to maintain the property, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But after paying the mortgage, he's making $900 a month on an initial investment of $6,000.
So I'm doing some math in my head. So it came in appraisal at $265. You do 75% of that. That should be greater than the $189 he put down. So he really, only his hard money lender payments was the only thing he had out of pocket?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The only cash he had out of pocket was to pay his hard money lender for that 3 months while he was doing the renovation.
That is impressive. And what part of town was this house in?
This was in Thornton.
Okay.
Yep. So north of Denver.
Now, if someone wants to do that strategy, they do a hard money loan, and then, you know, fix it up and refinance with, you know, 30-year fixed term conventional, like, when do you come to the picture? Do they talk to you
when
they're putting the final coat of paint on? Like, how does that work from a logistical perspective?
No, we definitely want to talk several times. Number one, they're going to get pre-approved with their hard money lender to go out and purchase the property, really before they're even looking at the property. So they're going to get pre-approved with the hard money lender, and then they're going to get pre-approved with me for the refinance of that hard money loan.
So before they even start looking at properties?
Yep.
Okay.
Because the hard money lender is going to say, yeah, I'm going to give you the loan, but the hard money lender wants to know, how are you going to get out of it? Because it's usually only 6 or 9 or 12 month term. They want to know what's your exit strategy. And if you say, well, I'm going to keep the property and rent it out, the hard money lender is going to say, that's terrific. You're welcome to do that, but I need to know how I'm going to get paid.
Ah.
I need your pre-approval letter from your permanent loan guy. And that's where I come in. So they're going to get pre-approved from the hard money lender and from me. They're going to go out. They're going to look at the property. Once they get it under contract, they're going to work with their hard money lender to get their loan. What I tell everybody is before you close on that purchase, let me look at your final settlement statement. Because I want to double check it and make sure there's nothing in there that's going to trip us up when we go to do the refinance.
Like what in there could trip you up? Because it seems like
cash back. So I've seen this. Okay. Some hard money lenders, let's say you buy the property for $150,000. The hard money lender is going to give you $30,000 to renovate it. So on the settlement statement, you're paying $150,000. They're giving you a loan of $180,000 and that $30,000 is coming back to the investor. I can't pay that loan off because that hard money lender gave you a cash out loan. You're going to have to wait 6 months before I can pay off a cash out loan.
So what would the alternative be in that scenario?
The hard money lender holds that $30,000 in escrow until you do your renovations, and then they pay your contractors or release the funds to you to pay the contractors.
In like third distributions or something?
There's a lot of different ways to do it. They can do it in thirds. They could do it all at once. There's multiple ways to do it, but the important point is that the hard money lender did not give the cash to the investor at the closing. And so I want to review that settlement statement to make sure that you don't do it wrong, because if it's wrong, you can't go back and change it.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Okay. Now, I know you do a lot of work with Pine Financial. Mm-hmm. Is this program only with Pine Financial, or you can use other hard money lenders?
Nope. I work with a number of hard money lenders around town. Pine is one of my favorites because they do a great job. I understand their process. They understand my process. But, you know, I would say we work probably 30% of the time with Pine. The other 70% is with various hard money lenders. There's some private individuals. Merchants Mortgage is terrific. There's several other folks that lend out of their IRA. There's several hard money lenders I know that are just regular guys that just have a lot of money. And so with all of them, I ask for the same thing. I ask the investor, please let me see that settlement statement. And they're always happy to share it because I want to pay off the hard money lender and they want their money.
Yes.
So we work together. No matter who the hard money lender is, we work as a team.
So going back to like the very beginning of that scenario, the investor is getting underwritten by you and the hard money guys. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming same underwriting guidelines, their debt to income ratio has to fall within certain guidelines.
Yep.
Now, can the projected rent from this property be used in your underwriting process?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So the property is going to be appraised after all the renovations are completed. And the appraiser is going to give us a number that says, hey, it's going to rent for $2,000 a month. Great. We're going to give you credit for 75% of that $2,000 a month to offset the mortgage payment.
Great. Okay. So crystal ball. Where are interest rates headed?
Oh, they're definitely going to change.
Well, which way and when?
They're going to change tomorrow and they're going to change again the day after that. So super great question. You know, I'll tell you, to be real frank, I don't study it a whole lot. I really don't focus on it a lot. And I've been saying this for years and years and years that I think rates are going to increase. And I've been wrong for the last like 7 years in a row.
You'll eventually be right there, right?
I'm kind of right this year because I told everybody in January, I think rates are going to go up, and they have. You know, I think the rates are going to continue to increase, and it's a sign of a really strong economy. So while it's a little painful that, you know what, oh man, I remember the days when I could have gotten a 3% rate on my loan. Well, that's great, but guess the economy was in the toilet at the time. Now, interest rates cost 5%, 6%, whatever it might be, but that means the economy is doing really, really well. So it's a trade-off, but I do think our economy is going to continue to improve. I think rates are going to continue to go up. I don't think we're going to see 18% or anything like the 80s, but it would not surprise me if we're at 6 or 7%. A year, 2 years, 3 years from now.
Now, at what point, I don't know if you know, historically speaking, at what point as interest rates go up, like when do they actually start impacting buyers and home prices?
I answer that question very clearly. If rates are below 10%, it makes zero impact in the buying habits of the United States. If rates go above 10%, that's when you're going to see an impact and it will actually begin to slow down the market. We did a study about 2 years ago on that. Rates below 10%, people need a place to live. Rates above 10%, they'll start waiting for improvements before they buy.
You don't happen to have like that published anywhere or that study, because I've said this to a few people and people don't believe me, because I've had Charles Roberts tell me that. I was like, really? He goes, yep, we did a study. Yep. I'm curious now just to...
I do have it.
Okay.
Yes. If you can help me remember, I don't have it with me, but help me remember and I will get it for you.
And that's something we can publish publicly. It's not like locked away in a lockbox.
Ready to go.
So really 10% is the threshold.
10% is the threshold. And if you go back and look at the 80s, rates were 16, 18, 20%. That made an impact that people did not buy at that time. But below 10%, there's no impact.
And what happens? So it hits 10%. Does it just like drop off a cliff, or do people just scaling back?
It's like everything. People scale back. People maybe buy smaller homes. People wait. It doesn't just stop. But that's the point that you begin to see that volume and number of unit count goes down.
Okay. Now, and just another long-term, you know, crystal ball question, where is the Denver market headed?
You know, I think it's, it still has a lot of room for growth. There's a lot of people continuing to move here. This is the most expensive Denver has ever been. But let me tell you something. Last year was the most expensive Denver's ever been. The year before, Denver was, that's the most expensive Denver's ever been. Over the last 48 years, it's been the most expensive time in history, with the exception of 4 years. There was 4 years that prices were down. Other than that, the last 44 years, this is always the most expensive the Denver market has ever been.
Really?
And I think next year is going to be the most expensive the Denver market has ever been, and the following year, et cetera. I don't see, unless there's a major external change, you know, major downturn in the economy, nationwide, a war, a nuclear attack, things like that, outside of, you know, something major, I continue to see people are going to move here. It's a great place to live, great economy. People want to be close to the mountains, and people want the jobs that we have.
So let me ask you a personal investing question, because you, one of your three rules for investing was a 7% cap rate or higher. Mm-hmm. You know, as you know, the past couple of years, rents have kind of paralleled with prices on going up. But if it ever comes a day where, hey, those 7% plus cap rate properties become rare and rarefied, are you done investing and then you go outside the 470 loop, or kind of what would happen?
You know, I would probably become more discerning on what I buy. I would not go outside the C470 loop. Reason being, I just, you know, I have a property manager that manages all my stuff. But what happens if he becomes an alcoholic, all right, and falls off on the wagon? Whatever the bad one is. All
right. We know what you mean.
Let's say this is in Nashville and he becomes an alcoholic and can't manage the property. All of a sudden, I have to deal with getting to Nashville to solve whatever the problems are. If that happens right here within an hour drive of my home, it's not that big a deal. So could the numbers be better elsewhere? Yes, absolutely. I completely recognize that. But for my personal sanity, I needed to be within a 1 hour drive. So I would not expand my search. I would probably just save more money and become more discerning on what I buy. And then, you know what, to be frank, would I look at a 6%? Would I look at a 5%? Yeah, if it's the right property. Would I buy it every time? Probably not. But I would begin to entertain. You have to loosen your guidelines at some point.
Yeah. I mean, you can't make the market change. You have to adapt to it.
That's right.
And so from a long-term, because you're a long-term buy and hold guy, right? Mm-hmm.
That's so, right.
I mean, one of the great things that's been happening is obviously appreciation. So you know what that does with equity in houses. So you have a HELOC on your primary to kind of fund your investing. Mm-hmm. I mean, as appreciation goes up and up and up, and you know, as long as it does, do you have plans on like cashing out that equity in your rental properties to go leverage up and buy more? Kind of what's the general thought there?
I don't. You know, I have 4 rental properties right now. And frankly, my goal would be to have 10 to 15 rental properties paid off over the next 10 to 15 years.
Okay.
So it's a long-term strategy. I'm not looking to take a bunch of cash out and buy a bunch of properties right now for numerous reasons. One, I don't like the risk of being over leveraged, number one. Number two, I physically don't have the time. I can manage about one new property at a time. I can't buy 2, 3, 10 properties because I have other things to do. I'm a mortgage lender. It's my full-time job. I do podcasts. I, you know, have a radio show. I have a lot to do. It's not my full-time job to buy and sell properties. And I don't want it to be. I want it to be, you know, it's kind of a little side retirement plan where I'm going to buy a handful of properties here and there. And it doesn't take away from my core business.
Great. So let me ask you this question. I enjoy asking this question to just successful people in general. Just knowing what you know now, if you go back to 2001 timeframe when you graduated college, wise yourself now, tell your younger self back then as far as just advice, whether it's business, professional, investing, just the general.
You know, I think the professional advice I would give myself is go to every networking function that you're invited to and follow up with the people that you meet there. I've learned that in probably the last 10 years, and my business has grown exponentially by following up with people that I meet and that I like. And I think back to my early 20s and I met a lot of people, but I didn't do a good job following up. And so nothing ever really came out of it from a business standpoint. But now I go to a networking event, even if it's just my friend's barbecue and I meet someone that I like, I get their information and I call them the next day and say, hey, Chris, I really enjoyed meeting you at Brian's barbecue yesterday. I would love to get together and spend some time, share a coffee or lunch, just learn more about you and your business and if there's any ways we could work together. And I don't care if you're a plumber, if you're a real estate agent, if you're a financial advisor, if I meet somebody that I like and I think I can bring value to them or they can bring value to me, I want to spend some time with them. And I failed doing that in my younger years because I just don't think I really saw the value of follow-up, but I do now.
So networking and then following up.
Yep. If you go to a networking event and you don't have time for the follow-up, don't bother going to the networking event because it's zero value if you don't follow up.
That's good advice. All right. So as we wrap up here, just any final tips or advice for helping investors or real estate agents that listen to this, helping them get their offers accepted? Because, hey, you know, it's a competitive market. Investors are competing with cash investors out there. Like, what tips can people do to get their 20% down conventional financing offer accepted over other offers?
Yeah. You know, again, this is a selfish answer, but I'll say you have to have the right lender. I see people all the time like, oh man, my client's been working with XYZ lender for the last 6 months and we can't get under contract. They'll change over to us. We'll get them under contract within 2 weeks. We just have a lot of things that we do that we can speed up the contract and take a lot of the risk off of the seller, things with appraisal, you know, getting those done quickly and so that no one's nervous about it. So that's a big one, is having the right lender, having the right team around you. I think the real estate agent is a very key factor. They've got to be solid. They've got to be good. They've got to write a good contract, spend some time with the listing agent and, you know, let them know, hey, you know what? I'm really good at what I'm doing. My client is really good. My lender is really good. This is going to be an easy transaction. This is not going to be a hassle for you, Mr. Listing Agent. It's not going to be a hassle for your seller. I also teach a class on 21 steps to get your buyer's offer accepted. And of course, anybody here in the Denver area would love to have you join us for that class. Check the calendar, which I'm sure you can access through the website here. That'll be coming up probably within the next 6 weeks or so. But we do teach that on a rotating basis where we really dive into those really in depth, all 21 of those points on what you can do to get your offers accepted.
And you also teach some other classes, which I've been to a few. They're great. Really good information. So how can people get in touch with you and learn about all the classes you teach?
Yeah. So my email, jmassey@castlecookmortgage.com. Cook has an E on the end of it. So C-A-S-T-L-E, Cook, C-O-O-K-E, mortgage, all spelled out, M-O-R-T-G-A-G-E.com. My phone number, 303-809-7769. Or you can check out my website address, www.loansbyjoemassey.com. Any one of those, you can reach me. And if you just want to be added to the class list, we send out a mailer or email newsletter every Monday. And then we also send out usually on Tuesday, the classes that are coming up for that week or the following week. So get us your information. We'd be happy to add you to that mail list. All of our classes are free. They're all open to the public. Some are focused for investors. Some are for first-time buyers. Some are agent-focused, but they're all open for anyone to attend. And if you are a real estate agent, the majority of our classes are CE approved, so you can get continuing education credit for those as well.
And actually, one just kind of left-field question for you. I get this all the time. I'm sure you do, but we'll clear the air. So Castle and Cook.
Uh-huh.
Your Castle Real Estate. Mm-hmm. What's the affiliation?
Nothing. Just a coincidence, actually, that we both have Castle in the name. So there's no affiliation whatsoever other than I rent space from Your Castle Real Estate and have been a part of the partnership and the team with Your Castle for 7+ years now. But there's no MSA, which is a marketing services agreement. There's no MSA with money passing back and forth. There's no affiliated business relationship. I just know that Lon and Charles and their agents do a great job. And they know that myself and my team do a great job. And it's been a very good relationship over the last 7 years to work together and bring really good value to investors and home buyers and agents.
Great. Well, Joe, I appreciate your time. I learned some stuff. I hope our listeners did as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate you having me on. If I can do anything else, please feel free to reach out to me anytime.
Sounds great. Have a good one, guys.